Phil, there are so many great television shows and movies.
That's right. Thank goodness Resonance Rewind has the team to analyze them on a personal basis with Robin Pierce, Jenny Bill, Jessica Burtis, Alex Lefchuk, and some key additional guests from the Temporal Nexus.
Aren't you one of those key additional guests?
No, I'm the Temporal Nexus.
There's only one first time for everything, isn't there? And only one last time, too. You think about such things when you get to be my age. That today may be the last time you sit in your favourite chair, or watch the rain fall, or enjoy a cup of tea by a warm fire, or even listen to Resonance Rewind. You must understand that when a person my age says he's dying, he's only admitting to the inevitable. Besides, we old people need to remind everyone to pay special attention to us. Isn't that right, Robin Pierce?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I intend to have on my gravestone, I told you I was sick. But what an episode we've got tonight, though, Alex. Star Trek Deep Space Nine, the 75th overall episode, I believe, season 4, episode 2. It's a really unusual episode in that it dispenses with most of the regular cast, even Michael Dorn, who had only just joined the series at this point. And it's a flashback episode told from the future. Confused? Let's make sense of all this, shall we? Jake Sisko, son of the series lead, Ben Sisko, is an old man and an accomplished writer, and he's met by he's visited by an aspiring writer, Melanie, played by Rachel Robinson, daughter of Andrew Robinson, who played Garak in the series, who wants to know why all of a sudden in his 40s did he quit writing. And he tells her his story. It all began at age 18 when he lost his father. Yep, you heard me correctly. Benjamin Sisko passed away. On the bridge of the USS Defiant, observing an inversion of the Bajoran wormhole. This causes a fault in the Defiant's warp drive, and a bolt of energy strikes him, causing him to vanish from sight, somewhere in the ether of subspace. Believed dead, he's mourned. But a few months later, Jake catches sight of his dad, but only very briefly. And from then on, every couple of decades or so, he comes into sight for a few minutes. So one of these visits, Jake is actually able to introduce his father, who is not aging at this point, to his wife, and shows him all the books that he's read, his accomplishments, and his father disappears again. And he begins to feel guilt that he's moved on with his life rather than try and rescue his father. So he changes the course of his life and decides to study subspace mechanics. Becomes an expert in this, gets his doctorate and everything, but at the cost of his writing career and his marriage. So decades later, the wormhole undergoes another inversion, which happens every several decades. And Jake attempts to recreate the circumstances that caused the disappearance of his father, but he fails. And it's during this visit that Benjamin realizes that his son has sacrificed his whole life in order to save him, begs him to return to his true passion and to live his own life his way. Basically a let me go moment. On the night of Melanie's visit, Jake knows that his dad's going to reappear again, and he's injected himself with a lethal hypospray, believing that by dying when his father's present, Jake will allow him to return to a time before the warp core incident. The next morning, as Benjamin appears, right on time, Jake tells him that his death will give them both a second chance. But to try and dodge that energy bolt, please, for the love of God. Jake dies in his dad's arms. Benjamin finds himself back on the bridge of the Defiant, dodges the enemy the energy discharge, saving them both. And everything is as it was.
Well, at least we can say that the man who's always known where his interphasic compensator is the very same Dr. Trek, of course, Larry Nemeczek. Larry, we've just reviewed, obviously, or at least we've given the plot line, in essence, for this Michael Taylor epic in so many ways. Very difficult, as I said last week, to actually watch without shedding at least one tear from that point of view. We'll turn to Jessica Burtis in a few moments and, of course, Jenny Bill to find out their thoughts on the episode. But this is something which features regularly. And I must admit, having just completed the second season of Picard, the Visitor does in one episode what Picard takes 10 to do. But there we are.
Yes. Well, I said that about Tapestry also, and that was about Picard. The Visitors, it's an acclaimed show. It's obviously way off. It's science fiction, but it's soft science fiction. It's like The Inner Light. It's The Life, or Tapestry, I guess. It's that off, and you have a big reset button at the end, and the whole show is what if and what could have been. But it was also great to see Tony Todd playing older Jake outside of the makeup he wore when he was in Star Trek playing Kern, who was Worf's brother. So it was, Tony Todd, the actor, became well known for playing a bad guy, for playing Candyman's, you know.
Without which Robin Pierce would not have an entry in IMDb.
Mm-hmm. So it was interesting to see, you know, Tony pulling off no makeup, no bad guy, no vibes, and this completely sympathetic role. Very moody. Right. The rain was also, never rains in Star Trek unless you're on Ferenginar. So the rain was very moody too. Really, really. Yeah. And the biggest thing of all, this was, they just had The Way of the Warrior, which was a huge action piece, brought Worf and the Klingons into DS9. And this was completely meant to pull things back a minute and have a softer, more introspective show. And it was just so well received. People's, you know, it's a lot of people's favorite, some people's favorite DS9 episode.
Oh. Let's turn to Jessica Burtis then. Jessica, your thoughts on this particular aspect of Deep Space Nine, of course, based apparently on the real life tale of a graduate student who once simply turned up on the door of J.D. Salinger, mm-hmm. and got an interview with Salinger, of course, the writer of Catcher in the Rye.
I had no idea, but I found this episode to be very good. It was very emotional. It was very intense. And I think the other episode that I watched for Resonance Rewind of Deep Space Nine was the first episode where Sisko sees his wife in those, the dreams, or I kind of forget what it was. So I think it's interesting that then we saw these ones where his son is now seeing him. And it's kind of nice, I think, if you watched those two together. It was very emotional. I feel like after I watched it, you know, you have to take a minute to kind of think about what you just saw. And mm-hmm. I like that the family connection was explored so much, because I feel like in a lot of the other Star Trek episodes that we have watched, you know, they're dealing with some conflict or something going on. I liked that this conflict was like inter-family. I liked that you got to see that human side of them. And you really got to, I feel like, know the characters really well in the short amount of time. I was impressed with how much emotion and how much meaning was put into that one episode. It seems like something, like you said, that would have taken a whole arc in a show now. So I really liked it. And I thought that the whole exploration of his writing was really interesting. I love that we got to hear about a writer. And I just, it's hard to kind of think of things to say about the episode, because I think everything just keeps going back for me about how deep the episode was and just how much it impressed me.
And if memory serves, I think David Livingstone also directed Emissary, the opening episode, of course, of Deep Space Nine. So clearly dealing with subspace was something he was used to. Maybe that's what happens when you go tromping in the bayou in the middle of the night, as Jake Sisko actually says, Jenny Bill, what did you make of this? Had you seen it before? Were you familiar with it, or was this the first time?
Oh, no, I have seen it at least. I've seen it before, probably more than once. I mean, what always strikes me is that it's a kind of a very much a standalone, because it's not really a typical DS9 episode. And I think watching it again, seeing it more as a one-off thing as opposed to being the cast of Deep Space Nine, I think I enjoyed it even more, because I have not seen it for a very long time. And when Deep Space Nine first came out, I didn't really like it because it wasn't set on an Enterprise. and then after watching Voyager, and there's like sort of, there was not really anything else, I went back and I would then watch Deep Space Nine. And first of all, because I was used to the Sisko, I was used to him as being Hawk in the other TV series that he did. And so I found it very difficult to see him as Sisko, and I also felt that he wasn't the strongest character. But I think that the program itself was actually probably one of the best Star Trek franchises when you actually sit and watch the whole thing. And I think that this is, it's outstanding. I mean, the acting, the story, the mood, everything about it. And as I say, when I very first watched it, I thought I didn't understand what was going on, because I thought, well, what's going on? The Sisko can't die. There's still loads of episodes left. And then being able to watch it again and thinking of it as a one-off, like just a one-off thing, I have nothing else to say, but just outstanding.
It's life, Jake or Melanie, and you can miss it if you don't open your eyes. A line which is repeated twice in the episode. I mean, Larry, clearly this is something which, rather like a fine wine, seems to get better with repeated viewing. I mean, maybe it's because I'm becoming more chronologically gifted since first watching, but even, as I say, when I first saw it, actually, it kind of resonated, obviously, with my own parental loss and issues relating to that. But it is difficult to kind of disconnect and actually cut the cord.
Yeah, I think wherever you are in life, this was an appealing show. And it is an atypical DS9. And DS9 is the atypical series, at least until now. Now we've got such a buffet of flavors, they're starting to diversify again. But whether you're on the younger end or the older end of the spectrum, I was just going back through some of my old notes from interviewing people, and some of it's on memory off and some of it's not, thank goodness. But originally they were considering hiring different actors to play Jake at different times in his life. And then when they had Tony come in, they realized that he could handle it all. And which makes it even stronger. And he's got the aid of prosthetics as he gets older, but didn't need any assistance doing that. But you're talking about acting. I should say Melanie, the young reporter that comes to interview him, is Rachel Robinson, who is Andy Robinson's daughter, just to throw that out. So that family feeling is pervading a lot of this episode on the meta level.
You're a good listener. That's important for a writer. Robin, back to yourself. Again, any thoughts from your own experiences in terms of watching this particular episode?
Well, I hadn't seen this episode since its first broadcast on Sky TV in the 90s. And that would be about 25 years ago. But I'm very familiar with the music score from the Star Trek 30th anniversary soundtrack album, and it's a very evocative episode, but I didn't do myself any favors. Deep Space Nine isn't one of the series that I've watched throughout again since it was first run. I've watched the first three seasons. I haven't got to four yet, so I was preempting a little bit. And as the episode progressed, I found myself kind of subconsciously second guessing, you know, but no, this is Jadzia Dax as an old lady. Whatever happened to Ezra Dax? And why are they giving over the station to the Klingons? Wasn't it the Kardashians that it, you know, they've got it all wrong. I mean, you know, I could see it as kind of a blip, but that magic reset button, of course, cured everything. And this is the future that perhaps could have been, because our futures are not written. You know, you might go left, you might go right. Everything depends on what you do, how you interact, and you know, it's the butterfly effect. But the one thing I did feel, which was the, I suppose, as Hitchcock would say, and Larry is gonna hate me for this, the MacGuffin, the plot device that sets up the whole episode of Benjamin Sisko phasing in and phasing out. It was all a little bit Tholian web, wasn't it, really? Or do I now have a death strike against me?
No, it was. I mean, it was, you know, there's quantum universes and things happen and things break down. I you're totally fine, Robin. Why would I?
You were giving me that look that says, phases are locked, son. Phases are locked.
No. That was my resting angry face, I guess, or something. I don't know. No, I was.
To explain to the others, the Tholian Web was a third season of original Star Trek where James Kirk is on a starship that phases in and out of reality. He's like an ethereal kind of ghost, and Spock and the crew are trying to bring him back. Only it doesn't take, there's not the emotional sort of buy-in where somebody spends his whole life trying to bring back the character. Mm-hmm. It all happens in one particularly tight episode and, you know, within, you know, a day or so, I suppose, all the time while these little Tholian aliens are building an energy web outside the Enterprise. And that's that.
I would qualify that by saying
it's totally not that.
The difference between the Tholian web and this one is that although Kirk is clearly tethered to the Enterprise and his relationship there, I think this one over a period of time kind of impacts it. Really from that opening shot of the elderly hand reaching for the baseball and the resonance of obviously the Sisko family's love for baseball.
I completely agree with you because right at the beginning, when I saw the hand reaching for the baseball on its little plinth, I thought, hang on a second, I don't remember this. I remember the music. I don't remember this. Is this an old Benjamin Sisko? Because I hadn't read up on it before watching it. And I feel very strongly that if I was to watch it again tonight or tomorrow, which I may well do, I would have a completely different take on it because I wouldn't be doing the second guessing all the time. And of course, when I saw it the first time, I had no idea how the series would end. That was 3 years away.
Larry, we must give special praise. I think
that's when I first saw it, I had no idea how the series would end. So we're all back in the day.
We must give special praise, I think, Larry, to the exemplary work of the late Aaron Eisenberg, of course, playing Nog. And again, given what's coming up in later episodes for Nog, of course, and I think there's always a paper moon or the episode of It's Only a Paper Moon and his own sort of experiences. There are lots of sort of aspects there which really start developing the Ferengi as characters in the same way as obviously our good friend and regular colleague and contributor Armin Shimmerman, who just has literally, I think, two lines in this episode, one more than Worf. But it is actually sort of interesting how that relationship between the Ferengi, Nog, and of course the human Jake Sisko kind of, again, is affected and impacted by obviously the loss of Ben Sisko.
Yes, and how you it gave you a glimpse. Again, this is a future, just the same way Q gave a future in All Good Things, the TNG finale. None of these. It's kind of a clue because they haul out the future uniforms that future Dax and future Bashir and future Nog are all wearing, and they have the future combat. I mean, the alternate reality future. So that's kind of a hint, but it brings it back again how, you know, Jake and Nog were buddies and portrayed as about the same age, but thanks to his kidney disease and the way it stunted his growth, Aaron was really about 15 years. Aaron was in his late 20s when they were filming DS9. And of course, Sarak was 10, 12, 14 and grew into teen. You know, we watched him shoot up like a teenager, but he was about 15 years older than Jake, which again helped convey that time gap and being able to be young with Jake, and you get that. But then, and thanks to the genetic disposition of, you know, Ferengi to stay short. So that aided it too. But I think, you know, had we not lost Aaron, he would have been ripe for appearing in all these modern series since he's such a fan favorite. But you didn't expect to see so much resonance with people seeing all these characters in a future and watching them all interplay, you know, with Jake, with Tony Todd's Jake being the forefront, but everyone else is basically playing themselves older.
So Jessica, back to yourself again. So we raised this when we were speaking with our author of the week earlier in terms of good lines for writers to develop and so on. What about characters and so on from your own perspective? Did you identify with anybody in particular, or was it one that you just thought of as an ensemble, the whole piece worked?
I feel like, you know, the main characters that we really saw in this were Jake, Sisko, and the reporter. I think I resonated with Jake's love for writing and his passion for that. And of course, it would be my dream to have books published. I think that made me so sad when he talked about how he just, you know, he wasn't writing. And I feel like for someone, oftentimes, I feel like everyone can relate to having a passion. And, you know, sometimes when you're not happy or you're focused on something else, you know, and then that passion starts to kind of not get as much attention, and how that can make you feel even worse. So I feel like I just felt a lot of sympathy and empathy for his character. But I also was really interested in the reporter, and I'm curious if she appeared ever again in the series, or if it would not have, I guess, yeah, made sense with the timeline. But I just thought she was so interesting, and the fact that he would have given her like a manuscript that he wrote with notes on it, I don't know, I just thought that was very interesting, because that's, I feel like for a lot of people, it seems it's very like personal whenever they're working on something, and you can see their changes, and how she said she wanted to see how he changed his mind. I thought that was really interesting with how we then see his decisions changing over his whole timeline. So I think everyone worked together very well, actually.
Sir Arthur, that same feeling I had when Arthur Weingarten, the late Arthur Weingarten, gave me a version of the work he was doing on Wonder Woman, Colt's Brain, back in the day. But life continues. Jenny, what about yourself? What about Karina? Of course, Jake's Sisko's wife, who we think is going to be a happy ever after scenario. But then he goes off, he gives up the writing, and he heads off to actually do his physics and cosmology, etc. And she just drifts away.
No, I think the character that I liked the most was the older Jake. And I also, even each time I watch it, I'm more impressed that how believable he is as Jake. I mean, you don't think, oh, it's somebody else playing Jake. You actually believe that it is an older Jake, because he plays it, even the sort of body, some of the sort of body movements that the young Jake has, I think he managed to capture those. And yeah, I thought that was... he was the lead, and that was my favourite character.
Robin, does this connect with yourself and Stephen Pierce? Is that how? I mean, obviously, you're both still alive, thank the Lord, at least in this particular reality. But any thoughts from your own point of view?
Absolutely. I watched this with Steve yesterday. And for me, it was Jake, the older Jake. I agree absolutely and emphatically with what Jenny said. It took me a couple of seconds to work out that I was actually watching Tony Todd, and it was the voice that gave it away, because the makeup was, to my eye anyway, incredibly convincing. And Tony Todd had the, you know, the tics, gestures, movements, little idiosyncrasies of the character, absolutely down pat. And as the older Jake, you could see him with perhaps a tinge of regret for what could have been, something that I possibly wouldn't have picked up on at all when I first saw it in my mid-30s. Now in my 60s, I can see it and I can appreciate it. And as you know, Alex, when I'm not watching sci-fi, I tend to be watching horror. So I'm more used to Tony Todd in various horror roles, Candyman trilogy, Hatchet, films like that. And, you know, what an extreme pleasure to see the depth that he brings to a performance when he's not trying to scare the living heck out of you.
And Larry, I mean, I think, in a few weeks' time, we will be looking at Far Beyond the Stars, which I know is Armin Shimerman's personal favourite. What about your own sort of character favourites from this one?
Oh, well, obviously, yes, old Jake, an ageing Jake. But I thought the ensemble supports really well. I think, sadly, the future defiant... with future Jake and old Jake, old Bashir and old Dax, I think the makeup lets them down. I don't think they did the best job they could have with either character. But it's a great ensemble show. And yes, Melanie, the reporter, comes out of nowhere. And I'm just going to, again, chalk that up to the good genes, acting genes there from Andy Robinson down to his daughter, Rachel. I think nobody expected the I don't know if they expected the chemistry to jump off the screen the way it did between Tony Todd's old Jake and her character as a booking device. Let me just throw something in here about the evolution of the show. So the story is, or the script is totally credited to Michael Taylor, who is one of three people that sold a story on DS9 and then wound up working on Voyager, because these were simultaneous shows. But it was like his first sale. He was a junior writer, and both Ira Bear and Rene Echevarria, who didn't get any credit, but he really did the polish and brought it up. And Michael will tell you about that. But it was Ira's idea to have the framing device of the reporter. Like the original story was told from Sisko's point of view as he bopped in and out looking at his son grow older, and they swapped it to be much better choice of Jake's. And then Ira had the idea about having the reporter visit. And again, the J.D. Salinger, when he was in his 80s, giving a young reporter an interview. So it's we love this story, but it's interesting to how a good story that caught attention just gets better. It's the evolution of, hopefully it's the evolution process in TV that makes the story better and isn't crammed for time and deadlines, and or at least in the old school way of doing TV. You know, had time to bloom.
I think that what really got me was towards the end, when Sisko, who of course wasn't aging, met Jake and realized that all of a sudden his son was older than he was. And that as a father myself to a son in his 30s, that was like, wow, what, you know, there's both a beauty and a tragedy there. And they work simultaneously, because I would like to obviously see my son grow up to be my age. But to suddenly realize that, you know, he's older than you, and, you know, no father should ever have to, you know, witness his son pass away like Sisko did, albeit momentarily. And as a father, and being the age that I am, all these resonated very, very heavily with me.
Yeah, it's we don't need a warp blast or a vortex or a time travel anomaly to do the real life time travel that we do. That I look at my kids, I think of my dad, or I look at my kids and realize where their ages are, and they're all getting up now old enough that, or I think of a moment in my dad's life when I was younger, and I start correlating ages, you know, like, oh, we moved cross country at this age, or this was the age my dad was doing this, retiring or whatever, or, you know, and you start correlating it, and it's almost like you're doing little old Jake Ben Sisko mind.
Absolutely. I mean, I realized a while back that there's the exact same age difference between my late father and myself as there is between myself and my daughter, even to the same amount of months. And it's really strange.
We're all co-creators on the journey. Jessica, what about your thoughts on this whole process? Is it something which, again, just has an emotional wallop, or do you suddenly sort of start thinking, well, maybe this is the whole life experience?
I think that, you know, this would be an unusual experience, but I think that it's very interesting hearing from the perspective of individuals who have children, and how their perspective is uniquely affected by that relationship shown in the program. Because watching it, it's, you know, something that I feel a lot of empathy and sympathy for these characters, but it's not something that I can personally like relate to as far as the connection. I guess I can think about my own parents, and just, you know, the love that children have for their parents. I think, at least from what I hear, you know, every parent wants to protect their child as much as they can, and that they would give everything up for their child to keep them safe. And in this episode, it's kind of like Sisko couldn't do that. And Jake, when he was even older than Sisko, decided to make the decision to protect his father so that they could be together. And I feel like that's the whole interesting part of this, is just the self-sacrificial nature that these two characters have for each other, that the love that a child and a parent have for one another. And I think, at least it seems, I don't know, maybe they show more like family connections throughout Star Trek, but I think this is interesting because it just focused so heavily on that. And, you know, there weren't aliens invading and attacking, or they weren't going somewhere and fighting somebody. It was just, you know, fighting time and the wormhole type of situation. But I feel like that's what made it really interesting.
That's a really interesting point, because the other thing which I got out of this was, in terms of the actual performances, the tears, they seem very genuine. I mean, Larry, I know this is a moot point, and I freely admit I might simply not be the target audience, but one looks at Star Trek Discovery and they seem to be bursting into tears at the least little thing. And you think, that's not the way life works, really. It just doesn't seem to quite connect on that basis. But that's perhaps for another program at another time. And I won't go into the fact that at least the good news about the latest series of Picard, mini spoiler for Robin here, is that there is an echo of one of his all-time favourite Star Trek episodes, Assignment Earth, except it's not Gary Seven who's actually there. It's another soul who's actually in there. So good news there.
I've seen the whole series, buddy. I've seen the whole series.
Well, then, there we are.
As we were watching that episode, Steve and I thought, well, okay, I guess we've got to accept Assignment Earth then. But I forgot to mention it to you.
There you go. Jenny, back to yourself in terms of things we've talked about. Anything you want to add before we go around for episode scores?
No, I agree that the only weak point in the whole thing was the characterization of Dax when she was older. I mean, I actually didn't even recognize her, first of all. And also, she made no effort to change her voice, whereas the Bashir character at least made an effort to look a bit stiff and change his voice slightly, whereas she was like this sort of bit of a blobby looking sort of body. But then the voice came out with this lovely young girl's voice. So That was the only thing that I thought, well, that's not really very good. Rest of it,
although she is a Trill, and Trill, it might be one of the benefits of being a Trill of the joint species, that you keep your young voice and your youthful voice even when the looks start going.
Even have the spots when she was older, now I come to think about it. I'll have to go back and look. Yeah, that was the only thing that I thought was a bit, but that, I know that has already been mentioned, that that's the only kind of...
So let's turn to Larry. What score out of 10 would you give Deep Space Nine's second episode of the fourth season, even though I think it was the third one to be filmed, The Visitor?
Well, I think you have to. I'm sitting here. I'm very hard on giving anything perfect scores. So maybe Jadzia's makeup is and performance is what makes it a 9.5 or something. I don't know, because I'm thinking of the other DS9s and other episodes. But this is, I have to, I'll say a 9.5.
And Jessica?
I think it would be insulting for me, who hasn't seen much Star Trek, to give this anything less than a 10, because it was just so wonderful and so deep and a lot more than I had expected from the beginning. So 10.
Jenny?
Well, I'm thinking exactly the same thing. I would have given it a 10 if it wasn't for Dax's makeup and voice. So I should be also giving it a 9.5.
Well, I'm going to go for 10 because I still feel that it does impact and it still connects on that basis. But Robin, where are you sitting on this one?
Well, I never do halves. I never do fractions. I was thinking maybe an 8, but I'm upping it to a 9.
Okay. Next, well, actually, I Larry, say really share quickly, with us,
Alex, that this was nominated for an Emmy, but it didn't. An Emmy for makeup, but it was nominated for a Hugo, which is what the World Science Fiction Awards they do. It didn't win. I just checked on this. It lost out to the Babylon 5 episode, The Coming of Shadows. But the other nominees were, and they mixed TV and movies both. The other nominees that year were Apollo 13, Toy Story, and 12 Monkeys, the film. So it was stiff competition, you know, that year, and they gave it to Babylon 5.
Yeah, 1990s, golden era, golden age, yeah. But we're still actually working through that process. And Larry, how can people actually still follow your magic Trek podcasts and so on and Trek files?
Oh, LarryNimichek.com is the hub. You can get to everything else. It's Larry Nimichek on Twitter and Larry Nimichek's Trekland everywhere else, YouTube and Instagram, etc.
Well, next week, of course, is the 100th episode of Resonance Rewind. And in keeping, obviously, with the Jubilee celebrations that are going on in the United Kingdom and so on and so forth, we figured we'd actually have to have something to deal with rain, because that's what Queen Elizabeth II is celebrating. How long may she reign? So we have got the Avengers and the classic, a surfeit of H2O. That's the Avengers with Diana Rigg, and of course Patrick McNee, and of course Granny Gregson's Grogs scenario, and much more with a surfeit of H2O with us. For now, though, for Larry Lamacek, Jessica Burtis, Jenny Bill, and Robin Pierce, keep on resonating.